big user of Island, lavished Levine's system with praise in an April 7, 2000 email. "Every day that goes by without your system going down builds my respect," he wrote. Ready, Arca, Betrayed have all been plagued with almost continuous problems at crunch times during the last 2 weeks. Island was building a reputation as the most reliable pool in the stock market. When traders needed immediate action, they knew there was one place to go. Without question, the answer was not the NYSE or NASDAQ. In the race to win the new high-speed trading merchants, the twin stock market titans had been passed, then lapped. None were more aggressive than Island. But rapidly coming up from behind? Archipelago. Chapter 13. Bad Pennies. Jerry Putnam sat in a room facing a gathering of Archipelago's board of directors. He could see his future right there in front of him. It had a name. Goldman Sachs. It was the summer of 1999, near the height of the dot-com bubble. The board had assembled in an expansive Goldman conference room on the 48th floor of Chicago's Sears Tower. Looking around the room, Putnam allowed himself a moment to relish it, to embrace the idea that the huge home run he'd been striving for his whole career was coming true. He'd been on the edge of failure so many times. Now he felt success was within reach. He gave a wink to John Hewitt, Goldman's electronic markets guru. Known as Spock at Archipelago, due to his uncanny resemblance to the brainy Vulcan on Star Trek, Hewitt had been charged with preparing Goldman's electronic trading systems for the 21st century. He'd handpicked an unlikely ally to help accomplish that goal, Archipelago. Earlier that year, he'd spearheaded a $25 million investment in Putnam's pool, giving it not only much-needed capital, but a stamp of approval from one of the most respected banks in the country. Also representing Goldman was Duncan Niederauer, a sharp, gray-eyed electronic trading expert and fast-rising star at Goldman. Niederauer would go on to become one of the most powerful figures on Wall Street, eventually taking the helm of the New York Stock Exchange itself. In the late 1990s, he was working behind the scenes to transform the entire market into a tech-driven speed machine. And there were few better places to effect that change than Goldman, which was rapidly extending its tentacles into every last corner of electronic trading. That same year, it purchased Hull Trading for $500 million. The forerunner of Goldman's vaunted high-frequency trading platform and employer of Chaim Bodek, Hull had been a pioneer in sophisticated, computer-driven trading strategies. Goldman was spending billions on investments in technology firms and on its own computer infrastructure. By the end of the decade, it had more than 20,000 personal computers and workstations backed by 80 trillion bytes of storage, about 18,000 miles of cable and 30,000 phone lines snaked through its Broad Street headquarters, linked to a fiber network that could sling data to its offices around the world at 6.1 gigabits a second. With Goldman on board, Archipelago would be an end recipient of much of the liquidity spun out by its own market makers, as well as Hull's high-octane trading desk. For the ECNs, such constant, steady flow was crucial. It was the new mantra: liquidity breeds liquidity. It was a fundamental law of markets, like gravity. The bigger the flow of trades, the stronger the pull. Hewitt and Niederauer's presence in the room was like a warm security blanket for Putnam. They made him feel safe. But others in the room had visions far beyond anything Putnam could imagine. After he gave a short speech and thanked everyone for coming, he surrendered the floor to Niederauer. Niederauer, a tall, heavy-limbed man with close-trimmed salt-and-pepper hair, stepped to the front of the conference room and picked up a dry erase magic marker. After a few introductory words, he walked to a whiteboard, wrote NYSE, and drew a circle around it. "We're going to be the electronic trading arm of the New York Stock Exchange," Niederauer said. The room let out a collective gasp. Just as Levine had used Datech to upend NASDAQ, Goldman was going after the NYSE, using Archipelago as its Trojan horse. The trouble for Putnam was that the NYSE was not only seen as enemy number one at Archipelago, it was seen as an impenetrable force. The Big Board was the establishment. That's why it was the Big Board. The idea that the NYSE would have any interest in aligning itself with Archipelago, still a tiny upstart, scrappy as it was, with roughly 5,000 subscribers who transacted a few million shares a day, seemed nothing short of delusional. But Niederauer knew the future was shifting toward fast computer trading, and Archipelago was drawing some heavy backers and fetching valuations, albeit on paper, north of $200 million. As Niederauer's presentation in the Sears Tower that day showed, Putnam & Co. were beginning to have grand visions of a future dominated by electronic networks. That's why Putnam decided to make one of his biggest moves yet. Rather than continue life as a plain vanilla ECN, Archipelago was going to become a full-fledged exchange, giving it the ability to trade blue chips such as General Electric and IBM. That meant only one thing. It was time to go head-to-head with the 800-pound gorilla itself, the New York Stock Exchange. Putnam didn't know which he hated most, NASDAQ or the NYSE. His disdain for NASDAQ was visceral. Within Archipelago, NASDAQ was the subject of constant ridicule. A NASDAQ towel, a Christmas present to NASDAQ customers, was used as a throw rug in the office. Archipelago employees loved to wipe their dirty shoes on the towel, which eventually became pitch black with Chicago street grit. But Putnam had a deep, stomach-level hatred for the NYSE. Once, in a phone conversation with an NYSE official, he called the exchange a monopoly. "Don't say that," shot back the NYSE official. "You're a monopoly," Putnam shouted. "Stop saying that. You're a monopoly," Putnam shouted again. "You're a monopoly. A monopoly." He loved pulling their chain, and he was also convinced he was right. A brash propaganda campaign against the Big Board broke out. Archipelago rented a Brinks armored car, parked it in front of the NYSE on Broad Street, and handed out rolls of pennies. The company put up signs around the exchange saying, "Don't get pennied," a reference to the allegation that specialists would front-run their customers by buying stocks cheap and selling them pennies higher. It hired fake protesters to march around the NYSE with signs that said, "Don't get pennied." Eventually, the New York Police Department forced them to stop. Putnam even contemplated dropping rolls of toilet paper stamped with the Archipelago logo on top of the NYSE from a helicopter, a locker room joke on the Big Board's archaic ticker tape past. He called up Archipelago's marketing guru, Margaret Nagel, and asked her to check into the legal implications of such a stunt. "Can you find out if it's a felony or misdemeanor to TP the New York Stock Exchange?" he asked. "Excuse me?" Nagel replied. While he eventually scotched the plan to TP the Big Board, Putnam relentlessly hammered the vision of the floor of the NYSE as a mysterious world where insiders took advantage of the little guy. Archipelago adopted mottos such as "Everything out in the open" and "The market is open." The implication, of course, was that the NYSE was closed and had something to hide. Putnam had a strong ally fighting alongside him in his battle against the NYSE. None other than his toughest competitor, Island. On July 3, 2000, Matt Andreessen mounted a platform in front of the Rayburn House office building in Washington, D.C. Behind him loomed the sharp-cut profile of Abe Lincoln on an 8-foot copper-toned cardboard penny. "Investors will no longer have to settle for industry-established increments that limit their ability to obtain the best possible price," Andreessen told a gathering of reporters and onlookers, including several congressmen. "When the U.S. Congress told our markets to be decimal ready by July 3rd, we took that deadline very seriously." He was talking about one of the most controversial and most feared changes coming to the stock market: decimalization. For years, regulators and congressmen had been pushing NASDAQ and the NYSE to start trading stocks in penny increments, or decimals, rather than the fractions they'd always used, a convention that went back to the use of Spanish pieces of eight as a common currency. NASDAQ and the NYSE pushed back, hard. If stocks were quoted in pennies instead of fractions, the smallest slice was 1/16 of a dollar, or 6.25 cents, spreads would narrow, crimping profits. Rather than buying a share of Intel for $20 and reselling it for 20 and a 16th, they might be forced to buy Intel for $20.05 and resell it for $20.10, a meager 5-cent spread. It was a change Levine had foreseen as far back as the mid-80s when he was peddling software to Wall Street firms as an 18-year-old high school dropout. Why could he buy a box of cereal for $2.45, but could only buy a stock for $2.50? Clearly, he thought, market makers had a nice scam going. The SEC had been mulling a shift toward penny quotes since the mid-1990s. In March 1997, Congressman Mike Oxley, a Republican from Ohio and the powerful chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, introduced a bill dubbed Common Sense Stock Pricing Act to force the SEC to mandate a shift to pennies. The bill was dropped after the NYSE, to preempt any moves from Washington, pledged to shift to pennies by the year 2000. NASDAQ followed suit. But both the NYSE and NASDAQ had been dragging their heels. By early 2000, it was clear that neither the NYSE nor NASDAQ would start quoting stocks in pennies unless Big Brother did some serious arm-twisting. In due course, the SEC mandated that NASDAQ stocks would start listing in decimal form on July 3, 2000. Predictably, the agency postponed the move after a major pushback from NASDAQ. Andreessen was there in Washington to give the market notice that Island wasn't going to wait any longer. It was moments away from a historic event, the first penny trade in the history of the U.S. stock market. The move went back to Levine, who'd been enraged by NASDAQ's constant delays on decimalization. To demonstrate how easy it was to trade in pennies, he decided to beat NASDAQ to the punch. Island would start quoting stocks in pennies on its own. Of course, penny price trades could only take place on Island, since other venues didn't price stocks in pennies. But Island had more than enough liquidity to make it happen. The move angered many in the industry, who thought Island was going rogue. Andy Madoff told Levine in an email that the message sent to the world was that anybody who isn't ready to move forward is basically dragging their feet. If Congress, in their infinite wisdom, forces NASDAQ to implement decimals before they're ready, it will be a disaster for all of us, including Island. Levine's response was terse. As far as I am concerned, he wrote Madoff, NASDAQ has relegated themselves to nothing more than a last-sale data aggregator and vendor. It's hard to imagine anything that could make the situation worse. To drum up publicity for Levine's plan, Andreessen traveled to the nation's capital to stage a press conference and the first penny trade. The honor fell to Virginia Republican Tom Bliley, who placed an order to buy shares of Nextel Communications, the Virginia-based telecom provider, using penny increments. Within the next few months, more than 10% of all Island orders were submitted in decimals. The pressure worked. In the next year, the entire U.S. stock market shifted toward decimalization, and spreads started to narrow dramatically. Traders going head-to-head kept upping the ante a penny at a time, until at last the spread between a buy and a sell for heavily traded stocks was 1 penny. One market maker would offer to buy Intel for $20.10 and sell for $20.20. The next would offer to buy for $20.11 and sell for $20.19, until at last the bid was $20.15 and the offer was $20.16. Such hyper-progressive trading proved extremely hard for human traders. Computers, however, could easily juggle the load. Levine, of course, was pleased that progress was being made, but he didn't think that the regulators had gone far enough. He believed that markets should be so malleable that stocks would trade in increments measured in fractions of a penny per share. In a December 2001 letter to the SEC, he recommended that stocks trade 4 decimal places out from a dollar. Instead of trading at 2001, a stock could trade at 20.0099. At the time, the SEC restricted such sub-penny trades. It still does, for the most part. As designer of Island ECN's market structure and system software, he wrote, I think my experience with sub-penny trading may provide insight into these issues. Levine argued that the rule was arbitrary. It was as if the government passed a law forcing car dealers to sell cars at $1,000 increments. The SEC wasn't convinced. But the ball was already rolling, and the change to penny quotes was going ahead full throttle. The shift would cap the work begun by Levine in the late 1980s. The result? Human market makers started to drop out of business in droves. Specialists on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange began to close shop. Their profits eroded so ferociously that most simply began to look for a new line of work. Taking their place? High-frequency traders. Chapter 14. Dumb Money. Matt Andreessen sat perched at his desk at 50 Broad Street, leafing through the latest volume report for Island. It was a Monday, early 2000. A chill breeze pierced into the room, even though his window was shut. The windows in the office were like paper, useless against the harsh winter blasts that whipped up Broad off the Hudson River. It was so bad that several of Island's programmers had taken to wearing gloves with the tips cut off. Andreessen didn't care about the cold. He was rapt. He loved his weekly volume report ritual. A moment to pore over the hard data showing the exponential growth of Levine's electronic pool. As he scanned the list of users, a startling figure made his eyes pop open. A new subscriber had started pouring a Niagara Falls of orders into Island, millions of shares a day. He'd never heard of this particular user. His only clue was the firm's identification code, IBKR. Still, he was thrilled. Whoever it was, they were more than welcome. Millions of new shares a day were flooding into its system. All that Island had to do was open up an ouch port like a hungry mouth and swallow as quickly as it could. As Andreessen well knew, liquidity breeds liquidity. His elation didn't last long. The following Monday, as he scanned the next volume report, he noticed that IBKR had virtually disappeared. Andreessen was stunned. What could have happened? He thought it might be a technical issue, so he asked his client team to investigate. The problem, they learned after checking with IBKR, wasn't technical. "It's a business decision, Matt," he was told. "Why don't you go pay them a visit?" The name of the firm, he learned, was Interactive Brokers. Based in Greenwich, Connecticut, Interactive was a giant brokerage firm for regular and sophisticated investors. It also owned a little-known, though highly successful, electronic trading outfit called Timber Hill. Andreessen made an appointment. Several days later, he drove up to Greenwich, about 40 miles north of New York City. He'd never been to the small, tony town of Greenwich, and didn't know that it was the home base of hundreds of powerful hedge funds. In the following years, he'd return many times. He stepped through the front doors of Interactive's headquarters at 1 Pickwick Plaza, a nondescript office park located in the center of downtown Greenwich, and was ushered into a waiting area. After several minutes, he was escorted into an expansive, low-ceilinged corner office with sparse furnishings. It was dimly lit, aside from the radiant glow of a large computer monitor. Hundreds of quotes in a microscopic font flooded across the screen. Andreessen grew dizzy with a glance at the buzzing stream of numbers. Before the monitor sat a trim, silver-haired man, sporting a close-cut beard and black turtleneck. He stood and introduced himself. "I am Thomas Petherfy, CEO of Interactive Brokers," he said in a thick Hungarian accent. "It is nice to meet you." Petherfy returned to his seat behind a broad mahogany desk and motioned for Andreessen to take a chair. The Island CEO had little idea that Petherfy, a Hungarian immigrant who'd come to America in the 1960s virtually penniless, was a legend in the electronic trading world. He was among the first traders in the world to use computers to price stock options in the 1970s. In the 1980s, Petherfy had been the first to use handheld computers on a trading floor, the Amex. He'd installed a complex device to flash trade signals using colored lights on the floor of the NYSE, a mysterious machine competitors called HAL, after the maniac AI computer in the movie 2001. Petherfy had created a vast global trading empire worth billions, all of it run by sophisticated, lightning-fast pricing systems he had personally designed. In other words, Timber Hill was the exact kind of client Island was built for. Smart, tech-savvy, and bloated with liquidity. But for some reason, Petterfee had shut Island off. Like Chaim Bodek at Trading Machines, Petterfee specialized in trading options. Hull Trading, where Bodek cut his teeth in finance, was one of Timber Hill's top competitors. As an options trader, Petterfee often had to dip into the stock market to hedge his bets, the activity that years later would plague Bodek's firm. He'd recently given Island a test drive, but something went wrong. Andreessen launched into his sales pitch. He emphasized Island's speed and its blue light special rates. "We're 10 times faster and cheaper than our competitors," he said. Petterfee nodded. "Yes, Matt," he said. "Island is faster and less expensive." "So why did you stop using us?" "Because on Island I do not make money." Andreessen was dumbfounded. He had no response and left Petterfee's office in confusion. On the drive back to the city, he tried to make sense of what he'd just heard. What did Petterfee mean when he said he didn't make money on Island? With a sinking feeling in his stomach, he realized that Petterfee was saying that the traders he was going up against on Island were too good. They were so good that there was virtually no way to make a reliable buck, especially for an options firm such as Interactive that didn't specialize in stocks. It was pros against pros, watcher gunslingers, super-fast hedge funds like ATD, bank trading desks, a rising new breed of high-frequency robot traders. It was a revelation. Andreessen realized that Island had made a simple, though profound, mistake. By being the fastest, cheapest, and most reliable electronic network, it appealed to the fastest and most sophisticated traders. The result? Island was a pool full of sharks devouring one another. Andreessen's solution was a harbinger of important changes in the market to come in the next decade. Island would no longer simply court the savviest investors, the sharks, the cheetah-fast hedge funds. It would start going after what on Wall Street is known as dumb money. In other words, retail investors. That meant clients of E-Trade, Charles Schwab, Ameritrade, and even Interactive Brokers. Day traders or mom-and-pop investors who, more often than not, placed relatively unsophisticated orders into the market that the computer aces gobbled up. It all went back to the cost of ignorance problem Levine had grappled with, which eventually led to his creation of Maker Taker. Market makers often didn't know who was on the other side of their trade, whether it was a tipped-off hedge fund manager who knew a stock was about to rocket higher or plunge, or a dumb-as-dirt day trader making a reckless gamble. Because of that ignorance, market makers often would only buy the stock at a low price or sell at a high price in order to protect themselves. The equation is different with retail orders from a discount broker such as Ameritrade. Market makers know they aren't dealing with a wicked smart hedge fund who can rip their faces off. Rather, they're typically dealing with fairly uninformed or dumb investors. Aunt Millie taking a 100-share flyer on Microsoft. Panicky Uncle Joe dumping his 50 shares of General Electric because of an article in Business Week. That dynamic reduces the cost of ignorance, making it easier for market makers to earn a buck. And many of the sophisticated firms using Island were, in many ways, acting like market makers, buying stock and then selling it in a matter of minutes or even seconds. But Andreessen realized, after meeting with Petterfee, that the sharks were starving. They needed food to survive. Of course, the solution amounted to nothing less than feeding Uncle Joe and Aunt Millie to the sharks. Andreessen didn't realize it at the time, but his revelation was a new twist in the evolution of a computer-driven market that would transform trading in the next decade. It was the start of the Algo Wars. The stock market, and almost all other markets, became a hunter-seeker battlefield of computer firms hunting for dumb money, or trying to detect the fat whale orders placed by a mutual fund. In time, the funds started fighting back, by creating their own smart algos, or by hiding in dark pools. Soon after returning to 50 Broad, Andreessen got in touch with Chris Nagy, head of trading for Ameritrade in Omaha, Nebraska, home also to Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. A sharp-dressing, clean-cut Midwesterner, Nagy was in charge of some extremely juicy, i.e. dumb, order flow at Ameritrade, one of the largest online brokers in the country. In other words, lots of Uncle Joe's and Aunt Millie's. Andreessen wanted Ameritrade to start routing some of its flow to Island. It was a hard sell. Ameritrade had a deal to send most of its orders to Knight Securities, a computer-savvy broker-dealer based in Jersey City. Knight paid Ameritrade for the orders, in return promising to provide a good execution for the trades. In the industry, this was known as payment for order flow, a practice none other than Bernie Madoff had pioneered years before. Island didn't play the payment-for-order-flow game, though Maker-Taker was similar in that it provided a sweetener for traders to post orders. So Andreessen had little to offer, aside from promising fast execution. For Nagy, execution speed wasn't enough to trump the hard dollars and cents Ameritrade got from Knight. Island would have to get its juicy order flow from somewhere else. Andreessen, meanwhile, continued to court sophisticated traders, including the most dangerous shark of all. Andreessen was in the middle of his well-rehearsed pitch, ticking off all the benefits that Island brought investors who thrived on blinding speed and nosebleed volumes. The instant execution, the gobs of streaming data, the dirt-cheap fees. And if anyone was in the market for speed, data, and low fees, it was the hedge fund he was pitching to, Renaissance Technologies. But the reclusive, white-bearded chieftain of Renaissance, Jim Simons, didn't seem to be listening. In fact, it seemed as if Simons had dozed off in the middle of Andreessen's presentation in a conference room at Island's 50 Broad headquarters, his Merit cigarette burning to a cinder in an ashtray before him. Was Simons actually snoring? Disconcerted, Andreessen muddled on, addressing his speech to the other Renaissance executives in the room, Peter Brown and Bob Mercer, the former IBM AI experts who'd turned Renaissance into an invincible trading machine. They were familiar with Island. They'd been dabbling on it for the past few years. But they were still skittish. Andreessen was trying to convince them to route more flow his way. The distinctly cool reception from Simons wasn't inspiring confidence. After his pitch, he wrapped it up. Any questions? Simons' eyes popped open. He yawned, lit a fresh Merit, took a slow drag, then proceeded to reel off every single one of Island's major weaknesses. Island was largely shut out of the largest stock market in the world, the New York Stock Exchange. That seemed like something of a problem, no? You can't trade IBM. You can't trade General Motors. Institutional clients such as Fidelity and Vanguard weren't using the ECN. Why not? What if regulators did anything to upset the model? Andreessen was shocked and deeply impressed. He realized not only that Simons had been listening to every word, but that he had an incredibly nimble and perceptive mind. That caused him to want Renaissance's business more than ever. He soon got it. The fund structure at Renaissance was something like a Russian matryoshka doll, with funds concealed inside of funds. Inside Renaissance was another fund called Medallion, which Simons had launched in 1988. Inside Medallion was Mercer and Brown's fund, Nova. Its strategies were completely automated and involved lightning-fast moves in and out of stocks that were rising or falling. Nova got a not insignificant boost from Island's appearance on the scene. The human market makers and specialists it had had to deal with in the past could throw a wrench into its fine-tuned models, which required fast and flawless execution. It was the same problem that would help scuttle Chaim Bodick's efforts to build an AI trading system at Hull in Chicago. On Island, human middlemen weren't a problem. What's more, the high speeds and low transaction costs, as well as the reams of data Island spit out, blended perfectly with Nova's strategies, which were driven by cutting-edge AI systems that went back to Mercer and Brown's days developing AI-driven language translation systems at IBM in the 1980s and early 1990s. Renaissance's relationship with Ireland wasn't perfect. Pathologically secretive, the firm was wary of sending orders to any outfit that might be able to peer into its complex strategies. It was suspicious of Ireland, for instance, because of its ties to the former Datech trading outfit. Inside Renaissance, the theory was that Ireland had been created to let Datech traders avoid the uptick rule, a regulation requiring traders to wait for a stock to tick higher before selling it short, hoping to profit from a decline. The uptick rule had been created in the 1930s to stop bear raids, when short sellers piled onto a stock and sold share after share in order to crack it. Traders using Ireland could simply ignore the uptick rule, since no regulator was monitoring exactly when each trade was made, at least according to Renaissance observers. An even worse fear? What if those Datech bandits opened up the hood at Ireland and started looking at Nova's orders? The risk seemed too great, at first. But it was clear that electronic trading was the future, and there was no fund more about the future than Renaissance. Initially, Renaissance had formed a relationship with Bloomberg Tradebook, known as B-Trade. Part of Michael Bloomberg's media and technology empire, B-Trade's hope was to transform Bloomberg's ubiquitous data machine, which sat on virtually every trading desk on Wall Street, into a tool that firms could use as a trading portal. B-Trade's aim was to capture orders from the big boys, such as Fidelity and Vanguard, which had largely eluded Ireland. Brown and Mercer wanted to have a shot at trading against that flow, which they naturally thought would be easy pickings for their space-age systems. To them, a fund manager at Fidelity or Legg Mason was about the dumbest money on the planet. But there was a problem. B-Trade wasn't getting the flow. The major institutions remained wary of the electronic pools and were sticking with more traditional broker-dealers, who operated directly on the NYSE or NASDAQ. Almost all of the orders coursing through the ECNs were coming from hedge funds, day traders, and sophisticated bank trading desks. The sharks at Ireland who'd alienated Thomas Petterfy. That left Renaissance exposed. Eventually, it became the largest user of B-Trade, accounting for about one quarter of all of its volume. Brown and Mercer started to worry that savvy competitors would deconstruct their strategies simply by watching what was happening on B-Trade. They needed to start spreading their trades around to other ECNs, including Ireland. While Ireland didn't have the juicy Fidelity or Legg Mason flow Renaissance craved, it at least had enough volume to help it cover its tracks. Eventually, despite Simon's initial concerns, Renaissance became one of the most prolific users of Ireland. It was perfect timing. "We remain optimistic," Simons wrote in a 1999 letter to Renaissance investors. "An inexorable trend towards electronic trading in equities is having the effect of increasing liquidity and decreasing transaction costs." The bots were growing, flexing their muscles, and becoming increasingly powerful. Timberhill and Renaissance, along with electronic traders such as ATD, were at the vanguard of the algo wars, designing programs that could trade automatically with little or no human intervention. It was just the beginning. The automated firms flocking to Ireland represented the first generation of computer-driven trading. The next generation would transform the structure of the market so dramatically that it would become virtually unrecognizable, even to electronic stalwarts such as Levine. While outfits such as Timberhill and Renaissance were fast, they didn't trade remotely as manically as the new breed of high-frequency trading firms, which would blast thousands of orders into the market every second. Many rose up outside of New York and environs, in the prairies of the Midwest, the deserts of Texas, the suburbs of Los Angeles, and would escalate the algo wars to a fevered pitch, in turn threatening the very stability of the market itself. In Austin, Robbie Robinette, a physics professor at the University of Texas, and Mark Melton, an AI expert who also taught at the university, teamed up with local attorney Richard Gorlick to form a computer-driven trading firm called RGM Advisors. Operating out of Robinette's living room, they designed an automated stock trading strategy that jumped in and out of stocks at high speeds, the AI program guiding its moves. Striking a deal with Daytech Online, they programmed the Watcher software to automatically execute their orders. Heartland, the former Daytech Securities operation, acted as the broker-dealer to mainline their trades directly into the Island computers through a cable that snaked down the stairs to 50 Broad's basement, where Island had moved its computers in 1999. Chicago's Getco, another high-tech player, started to send microbursts of orders for stocks through its broker-dealer, Octeg. Daytech Online's Ed Nickel once paid a visit to Getco's ragtag office at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and noticed that the sign on the glass door read, Octeg Getco, like a mirror image. Immediately, he knew there was something unusual about the small group of ex-floor traders running the company. And he was right. In the next few years, Getco would grow to become one of the most hyperactive trading firms in the world. Highly secretive, Getco became a prolific user of AI techniques that could learn and react to shifts in the market at the blink of an eye. Another high-frequency trader closely allied with Getco, a North Kansas City outfit called TradeBot, would become so consistently profitable that in the late 2000s, its founder would tell people that his firm hadn't lost money in a single trading day since 2002. Chapter 15. TradeBots. Growing up in the middle-class town of Weatherby Lake, Missouri, a small suburb on the north side of Kansas City, Dave Cummings became fascinated with computers while hanging out at a computer software store that his father, a Transworld Airlines pilot, ran as something of a hobby. At Purdue University, the future high-frequency trading kingpin studied computer programming and electrical engineering. After graduating in 1990, he took a job with Cerner, a Kansas City healthcare software firm, where he worked for about 3 years. Then, Cummings caught the trading bug. He quit Cerner and soon found himself swapping future contracts for hard red winter wheat, the primary ingredient of bread, and stock indexes on the floor of the Kansas City Board of Trade. Each day, he'd don a forest green jacket and dive into the sharp-elbowed crowd of traders and scream out orders to buy and sell, buy and sell. It was tiring, stressful, sweaty work. Long-limbed and rangy, Cummings had the meaty build of a floor trader. He had a pumpkin-sized head and steel plow jaw, his close-trimmed black hair prone to stick out at odd angles. Quick with a laugh, he also had a whiplash temper. But Cummings also had the brains of a serious egghead. When his analytical mind spotted openings, such as strangely wide spreads, he started jumping ahead of the pack by offering better deals, cutting the spread. It was exciting, energizing, and challenging, but it wasn't the life Cummings wanted. While he was making about $100,000 a year, he wanted more. One day, while reading about how IBM's Deep Blue program had defeated the world chess champion Garry Kasparov, the kernel of an idea began to form in his mind. Could a computer program beat the market? Since Cummings' specialty was pit trading, he naturally imagined a computer program that could replicate the actions of a pit trader. A robot could buy and sell contracts just as well as a human being, and much quicker, he thought. So, in January 1999, Cummings quit the floor. Settling down in front of his computer, in a spare bedroom in his home, he started to bang out a robot trading program. Like a broker, it would post buy and sell orders, making money on the spread. Best of all, Cummings wouldn't have to spend all day jostling in the pit. He could sit back in his office and watch his robot do the hard work. In October, with an initial investment of just $10,000, he launched TradeBot Systems. His first task was to find a broker to execute his orders. That posed a problem. The system he designed had unusually high turnover, so high that typical brokerage fees could eat away all of its profits. While the holding times usually averaged several minutes, it was still far greater turnover than most investors saw. He needed a partner who'd cut him a deal in return for the high volumes he'd deliver. Cummings started pitching his idea to dozens of firms. Fund manager American Century seemed like a natural fit. Also based in Kansas City, it boasted the tech-savvy investment team that had been among the first institutional firms to use Archipelago. But while the American Century team thought Cummings' strategy was ingenious, They also thought there was little way it could ever make enough money to matter to the firm, which managed billions. Other reactions were less polite. Cummings would fly to Chicago on Southwest Airlines and take the Orange Line downtown to pitch his idea. But Chicago's seasoned brokers laughed out loud at his computer demos. It was nice in theory, they told him, but no computer could account for all the chaotic factors a floor trader had to deal with. TradeBot would get smashed to bits trying to pick up nickels and dimes in front of a steamroller. The clock was ticking. If Cummings didn't convince a broker to take him on, he'd have to give up his dream of building a robot trader. He'd have to get a normal 9-to-5 job and slug it out like all those everyday schmoes he didn't want to become. Then, Cummings heard about Getco. One day in early 2000, during one of his Chicago trips to pitch TradeBot, Cummings picked up a copy of Futures magazine, a trade publication popular in the city's trading circles. Deep inside its pages, he came across a tiny ad for a broker-dealer with the bizarre name of Getco LLC. Cummings made an appointment at Getco's office at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, a 40-story skyscraper on South Wacker Drive known among traders as the Merc. Soon after, he met Getco's founders, Stephen Schuler and Dan Tierney, in a hot, tiny, computer-lined office. As Cummings explained his strategy using his much-maligned computer demo, he started to notice something odd. Schuler and Tierney weren't laughing. Instead, Schuler and Tierney were becoming increasingly excited. Almost immediately, they'd realized Cummings had discovered something amazing. Schuler and Tierney sparked a Cummings strategy for a good reason. They were also disillusioned floor traders who'd come to see electronic trading as the future. Schuler had been a pit trader on the Merc, juggling futures contracts linked to the S&P 500. Tierney had been a floor trader at the Chicago Board Options Exchange. They'd only recently launched Getco and were looking for partners. Schuler had begun his career in 1981 as a runner on the floor of the Merc. In the mid-1990s, he grew increasingly concerned about his future at the helm of his small brokerage firm, Schuler Group. He had watched in frustration as electronic giants such as Timber Hill and Hull Trading grew more and more powerful. He started to envision a world in which human dealers had become obsolete, a world where all trading was controlled through a computer screen. That worried him. His wife was pregnant, and he began to wonder if he had a future as a trader. Computers were pushing into every corner of the market. To catch up, he started reading everything he could get his hands on about how electronic markets worked. Then he met Tierney, a young, cerebral floor trader more given to perusing works of philosophy and economic theory than the latest edition of the Wall Street Journal. Tierney, who'd started trading on the floor of the CBOE in 1993, had been doing his own research into electronic trading and had become convinced it was the future. The floor would one day be a relic of history. All trading would be handled through screens and isolated offices in a global electronic money grid. On a Friday afternoon in 1999, the two founded Global Electronic Trading Company, or Getco, over a handshake. They quit their jobs and set up shop at the Merc in a tiny office of about 100 square feet. They installed floor-to-ceiling computers that at times became so hot the room temperature topped 100 degrees. Ethernet cables snaked along the floor. Computer monitors blinked along the walls. It looked like a wild experiment by a couple of mad scientists. To process their orders, Schuler and Tierney also launched a broker-dealer called Octeg. Their strategy was a basic pit-to-screen approach, trading on small, fleeting differences between contracts traded on the pits of the Merc and the computer screens in their offices. They focused on the S&P 500 futures contract that changed hands on the floor of the Merc and its much smaller cousin, a contract known as the E-mini, that was more easily traded on a computer screen. A Getco broker worked in the S&P 500 pit, taking orders over a headset. Schuler and Tierney traded on the screen. But their strategy, while profitable, wasn't as successful as they'd hoped. Since Schuler and Tierney weren't experienced computer programmers, they struggled to design systems that could handle screen-based trading. Then, Dave Cummings walked through their door talking about a revolutionary new computer-driven trading strategy. Cummings' high-speed trading robot was the system they'd been looking for, one that could replicate the actions of a market maker. They struck a deal. Getco's broker, Octegg, would also act as Tradebot's broker. Since Cummings was strapped for cash, Schuler and Tierney fronted him $500,000 for a stake in Tradebot. They also rented the trading program's source code in exchange for a slice of their profits. Cummings used the windfall to crank up Tradebot's operation, setting up shop in a small storefront office on Armour Road in North Kansas City. In short order, Getco and Tradebot started gunning an open fire hydrant of orders into the stock market, and the high-frequency streams flowed directly to one destination, Island. Cummings' strategy was simple, but it required massive bandwidth. Tradebot would post a two-sided quote, a bid and an offer, for several stocks and exchange-traded funds. For Intel, it might offer to buy for $20 and sell for $20.03, a 3-cent spread. Meanwhile, it constantly monitored the S&P 500 futures contract trading in Chicago for a clue as to whether Intel might make a move. Often the futures contract moved slightly before the underlying stocks. If the S&P 500 futures did tick up sharply, the algorithm would aggressively buy Intel while canceling its sell orders, simultaneously placing new sell orders a few cents higher, say 2010. If Intel continued to rise, the algorithm would become less aggressive. If the stock finally rested at 2017 bid and 2020 offer, the algorithm would only bid around 2010 while selling at 2020, trying to unload the shares it had just scooped up in order to cash in on the move. Tradebot was also very quick to sell if a stock moved against it, a strategy that went back to Cummings' roots as a floor trader swapping futures contracts at the Kansas City Board of Trade. A tried-and-true floor trading strategy was to dump losing positions quickly in order to be able to trade another day, a lesson learned by many successful SOS bandits as well. The strategy was essentially the very same scalping technique deployed by the bandits. Unlike the bandits, Tradebot was fully automated. It was mind-bendingly fast and juggled massive volumes, putting up hundreds of thousands of orders a day, far more than the first generation of electronic traders like Renaissance or ATD. ECN such as Island loved Tradebot's flow because it provided rivers of precious liquidity. Island's competitors were soon dying to get a taste of the heavy bot flow, but Island was the only electronic network that could handle that industrial-strength volume. Other ECNs, such as Brute, the network launched by Robert Greifeld, or Archipelago, were far too slow and clunky. They didn't have the computing capacity to process the orders. When they let Getco and Tradebot plug in, it was like touching a hot wire, and they were burned badly. The younger ECNs, not Island, would beg us to turn on our models, says Keith Ross, Getco's CEO in the early 2000s. We'd turn them on, and they'd call us back in 5 minutes and beg us to turn off. We were getting overwhelmed, recalls Bill O'Brien, a former executive at Brute, who would later go on to run Direct Edge. We'd call them up and say, if you don't slow down, we're going to crash. One of Island's technical advantages was that it never, or hardly ever, paused during the trading day. Other ECNs were constantly hitting the spin cycle because they were downloading the day's trading information onto a hard drive in order to store the data. They had to do this periodically in order to open up memory for more trades. Island's system, through Levine's programming alchemy, didn't need to save its data during the trading session. It simply kept gobbling up the new orders and asking for more, without pausing for a millisecond. And the Island team loved the gushers of orders from their frenetic new clients. Indeed, Island began to depend on them like a junkie getting a fix. One day, Getco's morning meeting ran long past the start of trading in New York, and they were late turning on their systems. About 5 minutes after the bell, they got a frantic call from an Island official asking them what the hell was wrong. Island was hooked. The rest of the market wouldn't be far behind. Tradebot in its early days certainly didn't seem to be at the vanguard of the new market elite. Its trading room sat in the basement of the small, dingy storefront office in North Kansas City, a dilapidated industrial no-man's land just east of the Missouri River. A team of five or so traders, associates, as Cummings called them, constantly monitored their trades on stacks of monitors piled high on their desks. The carpeting was gray, the walls were gray, and there were no windows or televisions. Water leaked through cracks in the walls during heavy storms. Cummings set up his office on the second floor, where he had several computers for trading. Each computer came armed with software called a trade bot, a program that showed which stocks the computer traded and the parameters that controlled its strategy, such as momentum or leverage. Traders could adjust variables such as the amount of money they were betting, and they had the option of pulling the plug when the market was behaving strangely. Mostly, the system ran on automatic pilot, like a jetliner cruising at high altitudes. For a time, traders could pick and choose which stocks they'd trade. Eventually, Cummings started assigning traders specific stocks. The plum assignment was the Qs, the NASDAQ 100 ETF. The only catch was that Cummings expected Qs traders to be the cream of the crop, at times making as much as $15,000 a day. The amount naturally changed from month to month. Other traders were expected to make between $2,000 and $8,000 a day. Losses were unacceptable. Whenever a model started losing money, the system would start scaling back. Cummings became so adamant about never losing money that on days when TradeBot's daily profit and loss was approaching zero, he'd simply shut the whole operation down and tell everyone to go home. By 2002, roughly 100 million orders a day were flowing out of TradeBot. As many, or more, were streaming from GetGo. Combined, they accounted for roughly 10% of all trading in NASDAQ stocks just 2 years after launching. Cummings' robot was tap dancing in and out of stocks at rates never before seen. TradeBot would buy a small chunk of a stock, then turn around and sell it in seconds, or less than a second. Just as the SOS bandits used the watcher to hop in and out of stocks at a rapid clip, TradeBot was picking off trading opportunities in the blink of an eye, able to make money on nearly every tick of a stock, up and down. Decimalization turbocharged TradeBot. Once penny trading kicked in, the ticks grew smaller and smaller. Spreads for the most heavily traded stocks narrowed to pennies, often a single cent. TradeBot could buy Microsoft at $27.69 a share and flip it for $27.70 in a flash. As spreads narrowed, NASDAQ market makers began to fall by the wayside. Penny spreads were simply too thin for them to make money. Into their place stepped the speed traders, such as GetGo and TradeBot, the new market makers of the digital age. Their presence altered the very structure of the market. Much like the SOS bandits of old, the high-speed, algo-driven firms often traded in small chunks of a few hundred shares at a time, since they were easier to buy and sell. They were more liquid. As a result, by the mid-2000s, the average size of a trade on NASDAQ had shrunk to about 500 shares from about 1,500 in the mid-1990s. Trading in ETFs such as Qs, the NASDAQ 100, and SPIDERs, the S&P 500, fueled the mania, since firms could trade the funds as well as most of the underlying stocks, often hundreds at a time. TradeBot and GetGo parted ways in January 2002. Schuler and Tierney were interested in branching into Europe, while Cummings wanted to continue his focus on the U.S. stock market. To regain his independence, Cummings bought back Schuler and Tierney's stake in TradeBot in exchange for a royalty-free copy of the source code. GetGo, still using Cummings' code, quickly branched out from stocks into treasury bonds, futures, and currencies. As they expanded, they snapped up computer equipment from busted internet companies and started poaching math and computer wonks from the Illinois Institute of Technology, a breeding ground of tech heads. Since neither Tierney nor Schuler were experts in computer programming, they didn't hesitate to pay top dollar for the best programmers and traders they could find. One of their earliest coups was Dave Babilak, a former trader at Hull who'd worked alongside Chaim Bodek and had even attended Bodek's bachelor party. Babilak left Hull in 1999 to form a futures trading operation called Blink Trading, which GetGo purchased in 2002. With Blink, GetGo had tapped into the Hull diaspora that was spreading sophisticated computer trading strategies across Wall Street. Like Automated Trading Desk, RGM Advisors, and Renaissance before them, Getco started recruiting AI programmers skilled in machine learning techniques. Highly sensitive programs would monitor reams of data coming from all corners of the market, learning dynamically on the fly which strategies worked best under a variety of circumstances. Getco soon became one of the most active trading firms in the world, in control of as much as 20% of the daily volume of blue-chip stocks such as General Electric and Google. It was a dominant player in treasuries, currencies, futures, and ETFs, pumping massive volumes into markets across the globe. A fringe benefit of all that trading was that Getco was armed with vast, highly sensitive market radar, able to detect the smallest shift in market direction in the blink of an eye across multiple assets around the world. Getco could then predict the future in a way few competitors could match. It was as if the firm had deployed hundreds of thousands of real-time sensors throughout the atmosphere to determine weather patterns, while competitors were staring at a rusty weather vane. Getco soon moved out of its cramped offices at the Merck into several floors directly above the trading pits of the Chicago Board of Trade. Rooms packed with cutting-edge servers alternated with rooms full of programmers, quants, AI experts, physicists, and even video game programmers, perched before stacks of massive digital screens that reached to the ceiling. The firm became a steady presence in Washington, D.C., hiring ex-SEC hotshots and top lobbyists. Former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt was an advisor. Getco, in its public statements, repeatedly said it stood behind open markets and a level playing field for all investors. But Getco, with its technological prowess and its hordes of money, had become one of the new kings of Wall Street. Its founders, Schuler and Tierney, said to be worth hundreds of millions each, remained shadowy, Oz-like figures behind the curtain. For years, not a single photo of either founder was publicly available. It was a deep irony. A firm that beat the drum of open markets and transparency was, in fact, one of the most secretive trading operations in the world. TradeBot also kept growing. Soon after he broke away from Getco, Cummings devised an entirely new strategy. It focused squarely on capturing maker-taker fees. That model Josh Levine had first rolled out in 1998 to reward firms for posting bids and offers. By 2002, nearly every pool paid firms to provide liquidity, typically 20 cents per 100 shares. At the same time, they charged firms that took liquidity 30 cents per 100 shares. By late 2003, as more and more high-speed traders jumped into the market and spreads narrowed, it was increasingly hard to make money through simple scalping strategies. But with maker-taker, even if TradeBot didn't make money on the trade itself, it could collect fees for posting trades. If TradeBot could pump enough quotes into the market and snap up enough make fees, it could have a strategy that was akin to an ATM machine, as long as every other high-frequency trader in the universe wasn't doing the same trade. The strategy had an ideal candidate for a test drive, WorldCom. In late 2002, shares of WorldCom, the telecommunications company that went bankrupt after an accounting scandal, were trading for less than 10 cents apiece. Some traders, including Cummings, quickly realized that a golden opportunity had opened up. The reason? Maker-taker rebates. TradeBot could place an order to buy 1,000 shares of WorldCom for a paltry cost of $100. But if it got the rebate, it made a dollar on the trade, that is one dime per 100 shares. While a dollar doesn't sound like much, it added up because the volumes in WorldCom were massive, with millions of shares changing hands every day. In other words, a lot of dollars were there for the taking, with very little risk involved. And since the market was so large, such trading was massively scalable. In high-frequency trading, it was all about the volume of trades, not the profit per trade. Of course, the frenetic trading sparked by such strategies served zero purpose for investors. The mania around WorldCom showed how the market was evolving into a giant electronic slot machine for high-speed traders plugging it for dollars. Millions of dollars. MakerTaker was becoming algorithmic steroids for high-speed firms, pumping them full of a steady flow of income for posting orders, while collecting fees from firms that had to trade, such as hedge funds and mutual funds. And all that high-frequency liquidity wasn't going into stocks to simply make markets, as its practitioners claimed. It was methodically hunting down every last hole in the market's plumbing to make a very fast buck. As Cummings continued to push his machine to the limits, he started noticing that at times competitors such as Automated Trading Desk were beating him to the punch on Island. ATD had placed its computers right beside Island's baker's racks of Dell computers in the basement of 50 Broad, giving it a huge advantage over Cummings' firm based more than 1,000 miles away in North Carolina.